Our speaker this evening is Lyndon Lamborn, and I had never met him before he came to the conference at my invitation, but I certainly had heard of him and a lot about him. And he's from the Phoenix Mesa area in Arizona and has quite a story to tell that I know some of you have seen on the internet and looked at the YouTube films that are on there about Lyndon. He's a lifetime Mormon and has a lot of family that, you know, thinks that he's probably, you know, going around the bend. But he's got quite a story to tell. And without further ado, I'm going to turn the time over to Lyndon.
Thank you, Sue. I'm really happy to be here. I realize I'm the rookie in the group. It seems kind of strange to be. Test. No. This one work? This one work? Test. This works? Okay. We'll go with this for now, and if. Okay. I'll just stay here. Okay, can you hear me now? Okay. Anyway, I'll start over again. This kind of feels strange for me to be in front of you since I'm the rookie here. I kind of think most people in here have more wisdom and more experience than I. Yet you chose me to speak, and so I'll do as good a best job I can. I'd like to acknowledge I have two of my brothers here tonight and my beautiful sister-in-law, Laura, over in this table, and it's real nice to have them here for support. I appreciate their special trip over. So each of us in our journeys have a moment of clarity for various things, and for me, a particular moment of clarity took place on July 23rd, 2007. I was in Peru with my brother Lee, who's over here at this table, and we'd stopped for lunch. We were on the way to Machu Picchu on the Inca Trail, and our guide knew that we were all from the United States, so he's being very cordial. He's asking where we're from, and they got to Lee, and Lee said, "Oh, I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah," and the next question, probably no surprise to anybody in this room, he said, "Well, are you a Mormon?" And Lee said, "Why, yes, I am." And then he knew we were brothers, so he turned to me and said, "Well, are you a Mormon too, Lyndon?" And at that moment, I had that clarity. The question hung there in the air in the tent, and in my mind's eye, I replayed the last 2 years of my life, all the research I'd done, all the emotions I'd felt, the mourning, the anger, the disillusionment, the disappointment in people who told me things that weren't true. And all these things came flooding through my mind. And in addition to that, here was a Native American asking me this question. And if I answered yes, essentially I knew that I was telling him in essence that, oh, the reason your skin color is so dark and it's not getting lighter is because you're not righteous enough. And All those things came up in front of me. And in the tent, in addition to my brother, I had my home teacher and his wife were on the trip with us. And so, of course, I had to answer in the affirmative because I'd been a membership clerk for 2 years, years ago. And to me, it's very black and white. Being a membership clerk, I'm anal retentive this way, I'm sorry, but it's either a Y or an N on the membership. Those of you membership clerks know what I'm talking about. It's either a Y or an N. There's nothing in between. You're either a member or you're not. And I was still a member. So I had to answer yes. But at that moment, I decided I never wanted to have to answer yes to that again. Now, Mormonism, just... When I was a boy, Mormonism was about the truth. And I was taught as a boy that the truth will always agree with science. There was never anything to hide in Mormonism. That the reason that science was advancing, the reason we're getting satellite communications, the reason radio and television have been invented, because the gospel is going forth to the world. And my favorite discussion as a missionary was the truth discussion, the F discussion. And that's what the church was about. And I was God's emissary. I'd been born in a special place and special time to a special family to carry the word to the world. And that's what the church was about. Well, it's not just a tabernacle choir anymore, as you know. As life has gone on, the church has become anti-historical. The F discussion was removed from the lesson plan in 1979. How many of you knew that? Okay, only me, maybe. Okay, but that was something, that's a telltale sign. The church is moving away from the truth, and of course, all polygamy in the Western United States can be traced to one man, Joseph Smith Jr., and all the heartache that goes with polygamy. And of course, we have the kooky underwear, we have celebrities like Mitt Romney, we have South Park, and the story of the angel and the sword. All those things now are part of Mormonism. In effect, I found myself on the wrong side of the humanitarian equation. I felt like answering yes to the question you're Mormon puts you on the wrong side of the equation, at least to me now, where I thought all these years up to this point, I've been on the right side of the equation, that I stood for truth, I stood for humanitarianism, I stood for all the good things in life, purity, but that has changed, at least as a result of my research. A little bit about the Lamborn clan in background, very quickly. I'm the fifth of seven children, six boys, one girl. All six of us served foreign missions. All six of the boys served foreign missions. We are big into education. All seven children graduated from 4-year of college education. All seven of us married in the temple. Okay. You're starting to get an idea of the Lamborn clan a little bit. We're from pioneer stock on both sides, polygamist on both sides. My great-grandfather Lamborn married his deceased brother's widow and spent time in prison, got very, very ill, actually, in prison here in Salt Lake City as a result of his polygamist. Grew up in Logan, Utah. My wife's sister married John Hales, who's Robert D. Hales' nephew, okay? So that's Uncle Bob. Uncle Bob is Robert D. Hales when we talk about him in our home. I was an Elders Quorum president 4 times, served a mission in Belgium, Brussels, 77 to 79. I was in the stake mission presidency. I was 6 years as a scoutmaster. A lot of people in the ward thought I was going to be the next bishop as I was doing my research, ironically. So I have up on the screen here, I ran the 2-mile in high school, and later in life I've run marathons, and I've always had a tendency to enjoy mathematics, and long problems and long events like a marathon are of course difficult, but they're not something that I feel are daunting to me. I did well in engineering school. The long hours doing homework came very readily, easily to me. The other thing I have up here on the screen is this is a helicopter. This is an Apache helicopter that crashed. I was trained for received 3 weeks of formal training from Boeing to be a crash investigator. How many of you have done crash investigation? Anybody else in the room? Okay. Crash investigation, the very most important thing that crash investigators learn is that, first of all, you never jump to any conclusions when you start examining wreckage. Okay. The second thing is a single piece of evidence means nothing. Nothing. Okay. You never jump to a conclusion or draw a conclusion based on a single piece of evidence. And so after the training, I was a crash investigator for about 5 years on the crash investigation team. And so not only did I learn it formally, but I practiced it formally. And this is a pet peeve of mine for people who take one issue and explain it away. We know that the apologists are great at that. They examine one issue at a time and are able to explain away. I think that's what got O.J. Simpson exonerated too. It's the lawyers took one issue at a time, beat it to death, and then go on to the next issue. But if you take all the issues or all the, you look for threads, common threads in crash investigation. You look for patterns. You look for trends. Then you assign probabilities to each theory, and then you decide which is the most likely theory. And finally, in the end, you have a chance to assign a most probable cause and hopefully a way to avoid a future accident. So that prepared me, I think, for my research into the church. I wasn't going to draw a conclusion immediately. I was going to look at all the evidence first and look for patterns and look for threads of logic. I think my logical background and hardwired mathematical circuitry that came with my genetic makeup put me on a collision course with the church that would eventually happen. I think it was a genetic inevitability. Spit that word out. And not much else. I had two nagging issues that bothered me for years. One was the Hoffman affair. We've already talked about that. Why would the church buy these things and hide them? And then the other thing was the infinite and eternal atonement of Jesus Christ. I never could get my mind around that. How other people on other worlds would have to believe in the extraterrestrial Jesus, and they wouldn't have any frame of reference for the Roman rule or the Jewish traditions that went with his ministry. How would that work? That seemed like a very dismal condition for all the numberless worlds out there. They have to believe on Christ on this planet. I waited for 25 years for that doctrine to be changed or to be clarified, to no avail, of course. So I had two events that really kicked off my research. I was running at 5 o'clock in the morning in Mesa, Arizona, training for a marathon, and my running partner said that she just read the book Under the Banner of Heaven, and there were some really weird things about Mormonism in there. And she said, are these things true? How could they possibly be true? Mormonism is such a well-respected religion. How could they possibly be true? And I said, well, I hadn't heard about these things either, about Joseph Smith's multiple wives, the Mount Metal Massacre, being rotored by this, you know, and all these things. But I'll read it, and I'll research it, and I'll get back to you. Well, 2 weeks later, we had the Lamborn family reunion. These are all my brothers, my sister, and my mom in the middle. And the Lamborn reunion is kind of maybe a little different. We usually have a work project at some point in the family reunion. And this work project was in Brigham City with my brother. We had some apartments there, needed to have some work done. So we went down, and of course, it was the man that were going to be there to work. And after we took a break, we sat around and we talked about the emerging information that was coming out, and that some of us had done some research and found that the church wasn't all that had been taught to us all these years, that there were some skeletons there that needed to be investigated. And we agreed that we'd help each other, we'd exchange ideas, and we'd recommend good books that were objective and fair, and we would proceed to really do the most important investigation of our lives. At least I thought it was the most important investigation of my life. I also made a conscious decision that I would never keep anything secret. I would tell my wife what I was reading, invite her to join me. If anybody asked me at church, I'd tell them. I took books, Grant Palmer's book, to church, read it during sacrament meeting. I took No Man Knows My History. I took it to church and read it. And I was never in the closet, not with my family, not with my church or priesthood leaders. That was a conscious decision. And I took this like a college course. I wrote book reports. I'm really anal that way. I wrote book reports for nobody, for myself. And I documented the key things I found out, the key threads that I thought were important. I summarized them myself so I could refer to them over and over again as I did more and more research and add to that. So I kept a record for myself, basically, for nobody else. This was the most important investigation of my life, and I wanted to get it right. Well, at this time, I was released as scoutmaster, and they made me the high priest, one of the high priest group instructors, ironically. Okay, and so, as many of you related, the things I was learning outside the normal curriculum started to creep into my lessons. The first one was on the Book of Abraham, and I said, Well, how many of you are aware that the Book of Abraham papyri were discovered in 1967 in a museum in New York? And there were about 40 brethren there, and I had, I think, four hands raised. So about 10% knew about that they'd been discovered. How many of you knew that they had them translated, and they had nothing to do with Abraham, and that it was just regular funerary documents that would have been buried with any mummy? Anybody know anything about that? And can you help me? I said, I have a friend that really has a problem with this, and I was trying to help him, and I don't know, what to do. So I had a good friend who's still my good friend, by the way. He approached me afterwards and gave me a book, which I read, and I also read by his own hand upon papyrus for a balance. And of course, I drew my own conclusions based on all the evidence. The next lesson was on Joseph Smith. So I printed out the list of his wives off of FamilySearch.org, and I printed off Zina Huntington's that she was already married, and I printed off Helen Mark Kimball that her age was 14 at the time of the marriage. I took that to the high priest group, and I said, by show of hands, how many of you know that Joseph Smith had other wives in this life and was married to them before he died, and that they were living at the time and everything? And then I had, out of about 25 brethren in that meeting, I had two hands. So again, just about 10% knew that he had a polygamous life. He lived a polygamous life. And I said, well, how many of you knew he married a 14-year-old? No hands. How many of you knew that he married women that were already married to other men that were still living? And I passed around the sheets, which they looked at with much interest. Okay. And there were no hands. Okay. So nobody knew about the 14-year-old or that he was married to women that were already married. And I says, this is all FamilySearch.org. You can go home and look it up yourselves. And I printed these from the church's own website. And I had brethren approach me after those lessons, both of them, and thank me. But it was always in the hallway, you know, in the dark corners of, you know, but they really did appreciate it. And I could tell that they were speaking from their heart. So I thought I was doing the right thing by sharing these things. Well, my last lesson that I taught in the 3-hour block, the lesson was on truth and testimony. Okay. Of course, this was a major issue for me. And so being a math professor, I proved the Pythagorean theorem for them as real simple proof, geometrical proof. A squared plus B squared equals C squared, right triangle law. And I said, okay, we've examined this. We've proven it logically. We could say, I think, with very high confidence that this is truth and we know that it's true. And everybody agreed. I said, how would you compare that to a 5-year-old who gets up in testimony meeting and says, I know Joseph Smith is a prophet of God, okay? Well, everybody agreed that probably very low probability, and that's really not something that the child could know of a certainty. I said, well, how about a 30-year-old that gets up and says, I know the Book of Mormon is the Word of God and a historically accurate work? Well, the brethren said, well, yeah, we think that's possible. I said, okay, well, you think that's really possible. Well, consider this. And then I told him the story of B.H. Roberts and his issues that he had back in 1922 and his in-depth research into the language and the animals and the crops and the anthropology and everything else, all the problems. And he went to the most knowledgeable people in the world to get answers, the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. And they... when he related all this information to the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, they were visibly shaken. They were crying. They realized that they'd been hoodwinked. And so, brethren, I saw the same thing in the high priest group when I was describing all this stuff. And I told them about the Book View of the Hebrews and how there's ample information that paralleled the Book of Mormon. And anyway, I had some brethren that were looking pretty sad at that point. And by the way, the stake president was in the front row. And the stake president took issue with my discussion, obviously, and we had to agree to disagree in the end. So It just so happened that 9 days after my last lesson, I had my temple recommend interview coming up. And my bishop was not there at the lesson, the high priest group lesson that day. And I apparently was unaware of the lesson. So he was totally unaware when he asked the question, do you have a firm testimony, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, well, I'm having some very serious reservations about the restoration through Joseph Smith and the historicity of the Book of Mormon. I have some really problems right now understanding those things and reconciling those things. And he was floored. But it was really interesting to hear his reaction. Let me describe it to you. His first reaction was, but look at everything we've worked for, Lyndon. Okay. So this is the escalation of commitment bias he was playing on, right? Yeah. The sacrifice trap. Everything we poured our hearts and minds into for the last, you know, umpteen years of our lives you're saying is not real. His next tactic was also very interesting. He said, you know, Lyndon, smarter men than you have done all this research, and they've all decided the church is true. Okay. So authority bias, right? And attacking my pride, pointing the finger. You're prideful because you think you're smarter than the Hugh Nibleys of the world. You know, and I told him, I'd read Hugh Nibley and his explanations on the Book of Abraham, and I'm never going to believe any authority of the church ever again, Bishop. I told him that flat out. He says, I need to make my own choices, my own decision based on my own intelligence, because Hugh Nibley is full of BS. Anyway, so his next tactic, what sins are you concealing from me, Lyndon? Okay. How often are you studying your Book of Mormon? How often do you pray? I says, I pray daily, Bishop. I pray for guidance that I will read the right things, that I'll draw the right conclusions, that I'll have my best mental faculties available to understand all the information that's out there. So I think I kind of gave him good feedback there. So the next question really took me off guard. And that was, who have you been talking to, Lyndon? Okay. Damage control. Okay. And I gave him I had about 25 pages worth of notes I'd made, which I gave to him at that point. These are some questions I have, Bishop. If you can help me, I'd appreciate it. And I was sincere. I was not being facetious or just looking for a fight. I thought, you know, he's an ecclesiastical leader here. He should be able to help me find the answers to these questions, if they are any answers to these questions. I'll say up front, the battle here, the escalation of conflict here that I'm going to describe was never personal. That I like these men. I think they're good men, and I think they're always good men. They want to do the right thing, but they're crippled. Okay, and just a preface to the rest of my remarks. So, what happened next was really by surprise. The bishop. So, yeah. Okay. So he called the bishops of all my brothers. Because I told him I'd been talking to my brothers, and I had an online discussion group. He called all the bishops of my brothers and suggested that each of my brothers receive a visit from the bishop and determine their level of commitment to see if there was some plot against the church that we were hatching and we were going to destroy them or something. I don't know what. I don't know what kind of threat there could possibly be from a band of brothers who are just sharing information and trying to understand our way through this life. That he would step in and do that to me was incredible. I confronted him. I said, I demand an apology. This has caused problems and is potentially disastrous for my family relations. This is a breach of confidentiality. I thought I was talking to you in confidence. The way I was trying to find my way through this maze of facts and information. And he basically refused. He said, no, I went to the Book of Instructions, and it says that I am to protect the good name of the church. Okay. I don't know what planet the church has a good name on, but anyway, that's But that was his mission. That's what he said was his reasoning. Okay. So I found out that confidentiality is a myth. Okay. Confidentiality is a Hollywood thing, or it belongs, it's some other part of some other church, but it's not part of Mormonism. Interestingly, it was interesting that he took my dissent as disloyalty immediately. And at this point, I was not disloyal. I wanted to continue to come. I wanted to continue to inject interesting information and help other members see a wider view of reality. And I wanted to be there for my family. I had no plans to stop coming to church and to stop participating at that point. And I was not disloyal. But it was interpreted as disloyalty, and that was disappointing to me. What followed next was sort of an escalation of testosterone, probably between me and the bishop and the stake president. There were follow-up visits with the bishop, and then I went to see the stake president. He asked me the same question: "Smarter men than you, Lyndon, have gone through these things." And et cetera, et cetera. So I got the same thing over and over again. I'm not sure if they have the same training classes or what. But they pretty much read from the same script, it seemed to me. So my big issue here was I wanted to spare my mother any pain. And I told the bishop and the stake president I was planning to do a very prolonged discovery phase. It'd be at least 5 years, I told them, before I'd be done, based on the rate and the number of books I wanted to read. And the reason I said 5 years is because they'd both been in, had their callings for at least 3 years, so I knew they'd be out. And basically could give them the expectation that I was going to be around for at least their entire time while they had their positions. The bishop had put me on restriction at that point. He said that I could not exercise the priesthood outside the home, that I could not give any prayers in public. And that I could not teach any lessons or hold any callings. And the more I thought about that, the more it made my blood boil. You know, I had just as much right to pray as anybody who walked through that door, you know, that they had. So I ignored their restrictions. And I prayed when everybody called on me. And I spoke up often, and I didn't care. And I continued to bring books. And I started to bring results of my research to church. I tuck it in my pocket. I had, at this point, I had a timeline that I'd constructed, drawing some of the key events and showing threads of logic and patterns with the church, and a 28-page, I think, summary of my findings. I'd stuff a copy of that in my church, in my pocket, my coat pocket every week, and then somebody'd say, "How you doing, Lyndon? What's going on?" I said, "I've been doing some research about the history of the church. Would you like to see it?" And I never got a no. Okay, always a yes. I'd give them the research. I probably distributed a half a dozen. And so the conflict continued to escalate. I'm sure it got back to the bishop and stake president over time. In October of 06, it was my son's ordination for priest. He was turning 16. And, of course, I wasn't going to be blackmailed. And so it was kind of an embarrassment for my son. But I think we talked about this some during the session already, but the priesthood thing, that was Joseph Smith, that was brilliant, you know, making every man a medicine man and having us buy into that, accept that responsibility and that ownership. And then also it's a manipulation tool, because now the father is expected to be worthy at all times to do the baptisms, to do the ordinations, to do the blessings, okay, and so on and so forth. And I saw it became crystal clear to me at that point. The next big event for me was PBS The Mormons, okay? And a lot of you remember that. The timing for me was just perfect, because all the issues that I'd been researching were now out in the open, okay? It had been discussed on television in everybody's home, and I could not wait to go to church the next Sunday after the airing of PBS The Mormons, okay? I was more excited than a little kid on Christmas morning, and I was not disappointed when I got there. I cornered my high priest group leader as soon as I got there. I said, "Did you watch it? What did you think?" And he said, "Oh, I watched about 30 minutes and I got sick to my stomach. I had to turn off. It was so biased to the anti-side, I could not stand it." I'm like, okay. And I argued with him for a minute, but that's irrelevant. So then during the meeting. It came up six times. I counted. It came up six times during the three-hour block. A woman who'd been a convert to the church in the last year had seen the program, and she'd had a conference in Provo and had an appointment to meet with Uncle Bob, Robert D. Hales, okay? And she asked, she said, I'm very overwhelmed by all this information. Nobody told me about all this stuff when I was converted, going back to deception for new recruits, okay? Don't get the whole story. And this is what Elder Hales told her. He said, isn't it a testimony, sister, that we have such a colorful and controversial history, and yet we have so many faithful members? Anyway, so for what it's worth, that came up. And then in High Priest Group, this was very funny. They were starting the lesson, and a brother got up and said, he said, before we start the lesson, I just want to make a comment about PBS The Mormons. He said, I thought this was the most fair, most the greatest missionary tool we could possibly have. I think this is a chance to use as a springboard to talk to all our neighbors about the church. And he says, this was such a nice program. They did such a good job, and went on and on about it for about 5 minutes. And there was the High Priest group leader who tuned out after 30 minutes. And just, it was just funny. After the block was choir practice, and one of the members of the choir came up to me and asked me about the program. And I said, I thought it was very good. I thought it was very balanced. And I think PBS was very kind to the LDS Church in this program. And so later that week, I dropped off some information with her husband, and they were a very TBM family. The next week, I jetted off to Virginia to visit my daughter. And she said the missionary's been trying to come and visit her and reactivate her for months and months. And I said, well, invite them over. Let's have them come over and talk. So they came over, and we bashed with them for about 40 minutes. And I laid out all the problems with, you know, all the stuff. And they tried to bear testimony. And I said, you know, elders, bearing testimony is declarationism. And declarationism is the last bastion of the unreasonable fanatic. And we're not going to hear it here today. They stormed out in a huff. So I'm not sure which thing got back to my stake president, whether it was the TBM family in my home ward or whether it was the missionaries reporting back to their mission president that Lyndon Lamborn was a loose cannon. But I got home, and 2 days later, I got a call from the executive secretary of my stake president. I was supposed to meet with stake president as soon as possible. So we tried to set up a time, but our schedules did not coincide until after the trip to Peru. So now it's just set the stage. Here I am. All these things are swirling around in my head. The escalation's happening. And I know I have an appointment with the stake president when I get home. And I'm having lunch with Lee in the tent. And the question comes up. I think what really went on here is I was too prominent in the ward. I was too well respected. I think the stake president felt like he had to discredit me somehow because of my potential influence on other members. I met with the stake president, and he said, Lyndon, why are you still a member of the church? And I said, well, you know, I thought about that on my trip to Peru, and I think maybe it is best that I have my records removed. And I said, well, who finds out, president? How does this work, and who finds out? That was a tactical error. I should never have said that. He used that against me later, but I'll get back to that. He said, well, I won't tell anybody. I said, so how do I go about this? I'd done all kinds of research about the facts and the historicity and all the problems of the church. I'd never done any research about the paperwork. I'd never anticipated doing any paperwork. And as an engineer, I hated red tape anyway. So I hadn't done any research, and I'd been too busy since I got back from Peru to even look into it. So I didn't know anything about how to do resignation letters, what the standard was. So I said, well, what's the easiest way to do this, president? He says, I'll send you some papers to your home, and it'll be self-explanatory. And I said, well, like, I can sign something? He said, it'll be self-explanatory. So I didn't know what that meant. So, well, 10 days later, here comes the letter, and it was a summons to a disciplinary council. Now what do? I didn't want to go. I just wanted to sign something and send it to Salt Lake or whatever the easy way was. But I couldn't not go. I had to go, because if I didn't go, then what would they think? They think I didn't care? They'd think that maybe they just disfellowship me. I didn't want that. I had to be excommunicated. I wanted an N on the membership. So I couldn't just not show. But then what should I say? So slowly a plan emerged on what I should say. And I decided I would go. And so... So, it was really strange, because to think that these men that were sitting around here had some sort of authority over me, it just really made my blood boil. That they would presume to occupy the higher moral ground, first of all. Here were men that I knew a lot of these men. I'd been on double dates with them, with my wife. I've known them for years. I've been camping with them, been to scout activities with them. And so this was a personal thing. And they'd perpetrated lies, perpetuated the deceit of the church unknowingly, probably. They're all guilty of bearing false witness, in my viewpoint. And yet they were here pretending to pass judgment on me. And I really became angry, and I had to stifle my anger quite a bit to be able to talk to them at all, really. Plus, it hadn't been very long since a young lady that lived within the stake had taken her own life, and I thought these men probably contributed to the environment of guilt and shame that surrounded that event. So, you know, I really think that real life is stranger than fiction in many ways, and this is one of those occasions. I had several objectives in speaking to the High Council, several points I wanted to get across. At Boeing, we have what we call an exit interview. When you leave Boeing, you get an exit interview, and to discuss any gripes you have, any people, and their gloves are off. You can say whatever you want, and then they try and take corrective action. So I treated this like an exit interview. One of the most important things I wanted to get across was the selective storytelling in the church did not work for me. I wanted to make sure that got back to the higher ups in the church. So, on the suppression of information thing, how do I do this again? I hit, oops. I have to do the computer. Okay.
Suppression of information, because that's what we're talking about.
Okay, he's trying to stifle me, he's trying to censor me here, ironically.
I don't know if that's your perspective. Well, I think it's the perspective of the founding fathers of this country, free speech. If somebody has some information, whether it be truth or propaganda, if it's denied my view, if I'm kept from seeing that information, if the information is true and the facts are accurate, then I have lost the opportunity to exchange a misconception I may have had with truth. That's bad. Let me finish, please.
He tries to censor me again.
If the information brought to me is propaganda and is error, which is entirely possible, then I can review that information, that propaganda, that error, compare it with what I know, and I gain a deeper understanding of the truth I already had in its collision with error. Either way, blocking that information does damage to me. That's why we have free speech. That's why we should share information freely. The church, I hate to say this, but it appears to me that the church suppresses information. And the real question here is not my membership, is that if the church suppresses information, take for example financial information, the church does not divulge their full financials, has not for the last 30 years, and does everything they can to not disclose their financials. I think that's a telltale sign. The question here is not my membership, I think. The real question here is if this is an organization that suppresses information, then why are we all here? We should be not just walking away. We should be running away from any organization that suppresses information. Censoring has been a telltale sign of corrupt organizations since the beginning of time. I'm sorry to have to say that, but that's my perspective.
Okay. The church gives five reasons. Jesus, it'll work. The church gives five reasons for why they feel it's warranted to have this selective storytelling. And we talked about one already, the milk before meat thing. Of course, they never get to the meat, so we have to dismiss that one. The one my stake president during my disciplinary council, the one he came up with was, you know, Lyndon, all these things are out here. The church never hid anything. Okay. Well, the church does hide things. They hide the financials. They close their archives. Okay. We have Hinckley Bind documents from Hoffman to hide. We know they hide things and they continue to. The other ironic thing is if your neighbor, the person at work, like I had, come to me with questions, if I don't know the answers, then it's my fault because I haven't gone outside the curriculum to find the information. So I'm guilty because I didn't go outside. But yet, if I go outside and find all the information, I'm ready for all those questions. Oh, you've gone outside the brethren approved materials to find the answers to these things. Well, then that's my fault too. So either way, it's a guilt trip. The other argument they use, the third argument, is that disclosure would do more harm than good. Okay. Well, first of all, that presupposes the church is true, first of all, and that the church is the best path to happiness. That's the other thing that you have to presuppose. Well, of course, the chances the church are true are almost nothing. And if we look at statistics on suicide and antidepressant usage, et cetera, it's quite doubtful it's God's plan of happiness too. So really the only real way to make this work is that disclosure does more harm to good than good for the pocketbook of the church. That's the only way that really works. The fourth is that the LDS church is no worse than other religions in terms of disclosing information. But that doesn't work either, does it? Because we have the Seventh-day Adventists and we have the reorganized LDS church, now Community of Christ, with their founders were in the same time frame as Joseph Smith. They have both at least partially come clean with their history and admitted that there were misrepresentations, okay, and they've made corrections. So the church has, it seems to me, purposely sought out and found the lowest moral ground and are digging in. That's the only thing I can conclude. The fifth reason, the church is at war with evil, and they should only present the one side. How does that compare to the pre-existence, you know? Christ plan where we have agency and have a choice, yet they're saying, no, we don't want to present the other side, just one side. So that manipulates us to choose just one thing, which sounds like whose plan, you know? Okay, Satan's plan. Okay. I got done with the selective storytelling and suppression of information, and then I went through historicity problems of the Book of Mormon. I was really emptying my guns at this point. I figured this was free therapy for me, so I made the best of it. People pay hundreds of dollars for a therapeutic session like this, and I got it for free.
And the problem here is, President, is when everybody in this room testifies to the Book of Mormon based on that spiritual witness. To me, by my standard, you would have the answers to all these questions, how all these things were possible. When in fact, I don't think you do. I don't think you have those answers. To me, that's a very false witness. And I think all of us in this room need to take accounting and be careful not to bear false witness. If you pick up an enzyme from the General Conference issue and read how the brethren bear testimony, they bear testimony in such a way that they are not calling upon, in general, an accurate historicity of the Book of Mormon or the divinity of the prophet Joseph Smith. You look at their words carefully, see if I'm wrong. But the reason I think they do that is because they fear God, and they fear the consequence for bearing false witness. And I want you, brethren, not to be guilty of bearing false witness. There are plenty of things you can bear witness to the Book of Mormon. It's got wonderful teachings in it. By all means, bear testimony to how you felt when you read them, how they affect your family. This is all wonderful things. But bearing testimony to the historicity of the Book of Mormon without knowing these facts is a combination of ignorance and false pride. I'm sorry. And I would urge you to take heed to these words. Now, let me close, and I'll sit down, President. You give me ample time. I just wanted to say that I think there's plenty of room in my heart for the church. My training as a missionary, however, prevents me from being quiet. It's just part of my makeup, I guess, that I tend to share things that I've learned and I'm sure of, and I don't think I can agree to any kind of restriction about praying or speaking up in church. I think it's really a question of you can welcome me as a brother, or you can get a court order and have me not come to church. It's kind of those two, the two options I think are available to you.
Do you think that was a little bit much? So, at this point, I thought it was over. This was the last hurrah. I figured everything was over now, and I felt really a big feeling of relief. This was great therapy for me. Boy, was I ever wrong. Okay. My proton torpedoes had really struck close to the heart of the Death Star, apparently. I really riled them. And so the stake president said I would be receiving a letter and a confirmation of my excommunication. And I said, great, thanks, brethren. I had a nice time. You know, I left. And about 10 days later, I hand-delivered by the executive secretary, of course, whom I knew for years and years and years, came to my house, handed me the letter. And it not only had the confirmation of the excommunication, but also that on September 23rd, there would be announcements made in all the wards in the stake that I'd been excommunicated for apostasy. Okay. And I thought that this policy had been done away with 20 years prior. I'd never heard any announcements in the last 20 years, and I went to church every week, basically. I'd never heard of any announcements being made in any neighboring wards or stakes. I did not know this was even a possibility. So I was floored. He said I could appeal to the first presidency, which I did. I wrote a really quite a nice letter, I thought, and with some good arguments in it, and hoping to bring some heat down on the stake president. That it would get forwarded to the regional rep or somebody, and they'd bring down some heat on him to forestall these announcements. I told him these announcements had no practical purpose. They'd serve no purpose, only shame and embarrassment and scorn to my wife and my son. I felt it was inhumane. I really, really reamed him out, but it fell on deaf ears. And maybe SpongeBob, maybe we should put that appeal letter up on the website one of these days. Just thought of that. So here, as I mentioned before, I think the stake president exploited what he felt what my weakness was, and that was having people find out, because I didn't want my mother to find out. I wanted to just continue to go to church and pretend to be a member when I really wasn't. That was my plan at that point. But now my mother would find out, because there are members in my stake that know my mother. You know, Mormonism's not that large of a community, and she would find out probably the same day. So now, again, I was in a quandary. What do I do? So I appealed to my online discussion group, to my brothers, and one of the members of the group said, you know what, with the PBS Mormons and Mitt Romney running for president, Mormonism is very up in the press right now. You might be able to get a newspaper to run your story. Then you can tell your story on your own terms. So he says, just take the fight to the people. And so I contacted the Arizona Republic, tried to get a hold of Steve Benson, couldn't. The East Valley Tribune editor, Spiritual Living editor, sent me back an email. He says, tell me a little bit more about your story. I don't think we're interested, but tell me a little bit more. So I told him a little more, and We exchanged a couple of three emails. Finally, he said, okay, come on down for an interview. And during the interview, we talked for about an hour, and his enthusiasm went from about zero to about 15 during that interview. And he says, yeah, we'll run your story. It'll probably be the second story in the Saturday edition, which they have the Spiritual Living. And then, of course, balanced journalism involves talking to the other side. So they called the representative and asked him in Arizona, asked him about these announcements. How often are these made? And he said, well, very seldom. He pressed on. What's the last one? He said, well, I think there was one about 5 years ago in a neighboring state. And before that, he says, I don't know of any others. So all of a sudden, his interest went about tenfold. And the editor started talking about it. He took it to the head editor. And eventually, I'll tell you what happened eventually, but most of you know already. That morning, I guess I'm ready. The story came out. Oh, I know what I want to say. This is O.J. Simpson. I'm sorry. This O.J. Simpson. Here, the church has more to hide than O.J. Simpson. They want to go toe to toe with me in a public forum. You know, they don't realize this weakness of their position. And going to the press was really the best thing to do. I agonized over it, but in the end, I feel like I did the right thing. And so the story came out. Front page, Sunday paper. They decided to run it Sunday paper, the same day as the announcements were to be made, on September 23rd. And there were, I went to church to hear the announcements. Okay. I was going to be there. I wanted to make sure whoever made the announcements had to look me in the eye. And I wanted to make sure that what was said was what they said they were going to say. You know, I wanted to be there. So I was there. The stake president was there, and no announcement. So I cornered the stake president afterwards and said, what happened? How come no announcements? He said, well, we were never really certain we would make the announcements. And now that with the article in the paper, the word will get out, so there's no reason to. So I don't know what happened exactly. I presume somebody from the higher up told him not to do it, but that remains. I don't know. It's a mystery to me. I will probably never know. Not that I really care. But just the threat warranted the article anyway. And it was a win-win for me because my wife didn't have to go through the scorn and the shame of having that announced in church. Okay, the story was told on my terms. And the bad press for the church was just, it was horrible. At least from my point of view, all my neighbors knew about it, all my friends at work. Everybody was talking to me about it, congratulating me, asking me for help. I made friends all over the place. It's just been a wonderful, wonderful transition into the ex-Mormon crowd, the best people on earth. And I just wish I'd done it sooner is all. That was the last time I went to church, by the way. So I answered that question up front. That was the last time I went to church. There were two follow-up articles. The first article went national on MSNBC. The online comments to the first article broke all records for articles in the East Valley Tribune. So many of you have asked me about what's going on at home. This is really a chapter that's yet to be written. My wife and son are still pretty much in. My wife reads her scriptures every day, and I show in the fetal position, kind of a self-defense mode still. It's only been 15 months, so I just figured to be patient there. But every day I'm more sure that I made the correct decision. I know in big decisions, a lot of us have made the big decision and we're out. Some of us that will listen to this and are here tonight still have a big decision to make. Some Indian tribes, when they have a big decision to make, they go to the oldest women in the tribe and ask them to make that decision based on the effect of that decision on the sixth generation. Of course, I think what they're after here is they're after, with the women, the humanitarian view, and they're after the long view, the sixth generation. And I think for me, looking at my sixth generation, this was something that had to happen because If I didn't leave, my sixth generation would be in a higher risk group for suicide, in a higher risk group for antidepressant usage and mental illness, in a higher risk group for being victims of fraud, especially affiliation fraud. They would be more prone to have to file bankruptcy and have financial problems, okay? Not to mention that they would become beasts of burden for a multi-billion dollar corporation, which any one of those reasons for me was enough to make that decision on the sixth generation. Now, I know a lot of you are not worried about the sixth generation right now. You're worried about your family today. And I know it's heartbreaking, and it was a big, I didn't want my mom to find out either. I know exactly how you feel. I recently read a book called Healthy at 100 by John Robbins that talks about how many cultures, they treat their elderly totally different than we do in our Western culture. They expect them to continue to contribute late in life. They have lots of high percentage of their citizenry living to be over 100 years old, and they continue to contribute positively. In our Western culture, we treat our elderly like they've made their contribution. We put them out to pasture. We don't expect anything out of them, and we just let them have rest and repose for the rest of their days. And to some degree, I think we do them a disservice by treating them that way. And I think for my mother, at first I thought it was going to be horrible and I'd put her through unnecessary pain, but I think it's been to some degree a little bit healthy for her. And I don't think my brothers agree with me on this yet, but I'm still working on them. I think if we expect our uncles and our aunts and our parents and our grandparents, when we leave Mormonism, I think it's healthy for them. I do. I think a lot of us underestimate their resilience in recovering from these situations and these changes, their ability to assimilate change. Plus, the other benefits, my brothers can fly under the radar much more easy because I'm the black sheep. I'm taking all the heat. So that's another thing that's a positive. I think you set an example for, I got tons of cousins and so forth, that maybe now they'll have a chance to reevaluate sometime in their life. They may get a chance to break out of some kind of mind control organization. Maybe it won't be the church, maybe it'll be something else. But it'll help them think outside the box, having an example in family. In closing, Dire Straits wrote a song that describes 50 East Temple quite well in the second verse, and I'd like to read you that second verse. It's from the song The Man's Too Strong. I've legalized robbery, called it belief. I've run with the money and hid like a thief. I've rewritten history with my armies and my crooks. Invented memories, I did burn all the books. And I can hear his laughter, I can still hear his song. The man's too big, the man's too strong. And he is strong at 50 East Temple. I'd like to go on and some more thoughts on this Dire Strait. And this, in closing, yes, we've legalized robbery and called it faith, but that is not all. We've vaunted gullibility and called it faith. We've sanctioned discrimination and called it faith. We've numbed our intellect with conformity and called it faith. We've surrendered our free will and called it faith. We've granted power to demons and called it faith. We've apologized for reality and facts and called it faith. We've traded our sanity for security and called it faith. We've declared ourselves the chosen ones and spat upon our neighbor and called it faith. We've justified selective storytelling and called it faith. We've abused our children with guilt and shame and fear, and we've called it faith. We've embraced delusions, called it faith. We've perpetuated lies and called it faith. We've feared the imaginary and called it faith. The truth is that no faith is better than misdirected faith. Thank you. Any questions? Hopefully I covered everything. Yes. Imagine that somebody brought in a tape recorder. There are certain MP3 players that have a record function. My son-in-law was able to edit out the sound of my heartbeat. Quite possibly was my recording. An alleged recording was made, yes. Yeah. Other questions? Yes. Yes. No. No. Maybe. They make their own way. I think all their membership records are still intact right now. But they make their own decisions. I love them all. And I don't think our family love has been diminished at all throughout this whole thing. I've been very, very lucky. By the way, my wife grew up out in the mission field. She grew up in Denver and Atlanta and Missouri. And she's always had non-member friends her whole life. And I think that's prepared her uniquely for this situation to tolerate my disbelief. Yes. Have I spoken to directly to my mother? Yes. I hung up on her one time. I just listened to Hinckley's talk. Is one of his last talks about the Book of Mormon. He says, here's the Book of Mormon. There's never been any alternate explanation for this book. You know, it had to come from God. All other explanations have fallen under their own weight. And I said, Mom, I heard that talk, and he's either totally inept and misinformed and belongs not to be in front of anybody with any kind of authority because he's misinformed, because there are lots of explanations on how this book could mean, or he's lying to us. And I don't take that lightly, to have somebody in a position of authority lying to so many people. And she says, well, he's a prophet of God, Lyndon. He would not lie. And I hung up the phone. That was the last time she really talked to me about anything to do with the church. She called back and apologized. Yes.
I might have missed this, but when the dude asked you if you were LDS, what was your answer?
I had to answer yes, of course, because I'm anal. Okay. And I knew that the membership record said yes with a Y, so I had to answer yes. Other questions? Well done. Let's have some beer.